This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, a distinguished professor of political science explains how money shapes the politics of both major U.S. political parties. Mass black incarceration in the United States shares many characteristics with Israeli repression of Palestinians. And Black Agenda Report's Margaret Kimberly sizes up U.S. imperialism on the 4th of July.
But first, in a few weeks, Philadelphia will host the Democratic National Convention and thousands of protesters who would like to shut the whole thing down. We spoke with Erica Mines of the Philly Coalition for Real Justice, part of the People of Color DNC resistance against police terrorism and state repression. They teamed up with Shut Down DNC for a march at the height of the convention on Tuesday, July 26th. But Philadelphia officials have not yet granted them a parade permit. Mines doesn't expect fairness from the city.
We don't trust the city because Mayor Kinney is a newly elected mayor who campaigned in the black and brown communities specifically to ending stop and frisk, but has now reneged on his policies around ending stop and frisk and says that he will now do what he can do to make pedestrian investigations as constitutional as possible, even though there's significant information that has been submitted that specifically says that black and Latino men in the city have been stopped at a proportionately higher rate than any other group of people in the city, and that 50 to 80% of those stops were found to be unconstitutional and without warrant and without even leading to some form of arrest or needing to be arrested or detained.
Now, you and your organization have been holding a series of protests in Philadelphia against police terrorism. But why wouldn't the city want you to do that when the DNC is in town?
We've been making a lot of noise specifically in this city, especially around holding police accountable for their actions and the way that they interact in our community, police accountability and transparency. We've been doing work around the brutal murder of Brandon Tate Brown, whose death resulted because of the stop and frisk policy and the fact that the police officers who murdered them were found to have been guilty and the murder unjustified, and that they are still allowed to roam and patrol our streets. Also, understanding that this is the city where the MOVE bomb took place in 1985, killing 11 men, women, and children, and none of our city officials ever having been held accountable for that as well.
And you want to hold the DNC accountable as well?
Yes, we do. What they're doing now is they're implementing this $100 citation fine for the protesters right now. And the $100 fine is supposed to be a way of decriminalizing protesters' rights to freedom of speech movement for blocking streets or disrupting traffic and things like that. But the problem with the $100 citation fine is that we will have the long-term effects of that after the DNC is gone. And so it will be then used as a way to recriminalize the poverty-stricken community, such as those who cannot afford those fines, and the homeless community, too, who suffers the bulk of receiving citations because of, like, panhandling and things of that nature. And the fact that it's a direct step to discredit our First and Second Amendment rights to freedom of speech and freedom of assembly, freedom to protest, and our amendment to confront our government on the horribleness of this so-called establishment and democracy.
How many protesters do you expect to be in town, and how many do you expect will protest with you?
As of now, the city has gotten about 21 permits for protests, and I believe about 9 of them have been approved. our organization, the Philly Coalition for Real Justice, is organizing specifically a Black resistance march around police terrorism and state repression. And so we are organizing not just in the Black community, but the brown communities as well. We're raising the Palestinian issues. We're raising the issues in Puerto Rico. We're going to organize and speak directly to our issues that impact our communities the most, because that's what's being forgotten in this entire congregation of those coming into the city as activists and the delegates as a whole and the presidential nominee. The city is one of the largest cities in this country, but we have one of the highest rates of poverty. We have redlining issues. We have gentrification. We have an underfunded school. We have police brutality. And they seem to be forgetting that all of the struggles that we are lifting up in this moment in time has always fallen on the backs of the Black and brown people in this country.
You and other protesters say that you expect to gain support from members of the Bernie Sanders movement and other organizations, but have you gotten any blessings from the Sanders camp or any organized parts of it?
We have received solidarity from the Black Men for Bernie's group. We have received solidarity from the People's Revolution, who was having a convening here. We have gotten solidarity from the socialist convergence that's taking place here, but a direct support from some of the larger Bernie Sanders groups, no, we have not gotten any type of solidarity statements or outreach towards our struggles, which has been one of the larger struggles overall in the organizing and planning of the DNC.
It's become kind of clear that this is going to be a coronation of Hillary Clinton, as far as the Democratic Party is concerned. Lots of Hillary Clinton forces seem to be saying that everybody ought to stop what they're doing and unite to stop Trump, who they call a fascist. What do you say to that?
Mm-hmm. I would probably say that Hillary Clinton is also a fascist. And they can say that we need to unite to stop Trump all day long, but Hillary Clinton is also a fascist and an imperialist warmonger, and we need to unite to bring down both the Republican and the Democratic Party, because both of them are failing, and we are seeing this now, and neither one of them actually wants to serve the best interests of the working class struggles in this country. They are only here to profit off of people's pain, particularly the poor and the disenfranchised community. So if we're going to collaborate to bring down any one of those infrastructures, it should be to bring down the entire establishment that allows the Republican and the Democratic Party to function and exist in the way that it does.
And so you think the city is trying to hold up your march because they don't want you to rain on Hillary's parade?
Well, this is a Democratic city. This is the city that hosted Hillary Clinton multiple times here. This is the Democratic city that allowed her to come in and, again, profit off of the pain of the Black mothers who have lost their sons to police terrorism, such as Tanya Brown Dickinson. She came and rubbed elbows and just to come here. And we know that Hillary Clinton really don't care about Black people in our struggles. She only cares about Black votes. And this is what she did. She comes here. She garnered support by aligning herself with our struggles. She goes into our Black churches and she schmooze with the people on religious politics and things like that. And so this is a Democratic city. This is a Democratic Party that knows exactly how to speak the language of the politicians and how to also sell their people out and over to the very same people and system that are continually perpetuating the oppression that we live in. So, yes.
Philadelphia police have a well-deserved reputation for brutality. How do you expect mm-hmm. them to comport themselves at the convention?
I expect them to be that which they are, which is violent, aggressive, and very direct in their brutality and their force. They put in, I believe it was a $43 million grant or loan for riot gear to use that as a just in case tactic, but they have already, they're opening up three prisons to detain protesters. I already know that they are gearing up to suppress us in the strongest way possible that they can with the force defense agencies. We are already seeing the up ante of police presence here. The counterintelligence forces are on the ground. Homeland Security has been on the ground. Transit Authority has been on the ground. We're seeing more police presence in our occupations on foot patrol. So the police presence is here, and they are already like upping the ante as far as like making sure that the city remains suppressed before the DNC gets here.
You say that nine organizations have already gotten permission for their parades. How would you describe the politics of those nine?
I would say I believe four or five of them have went to the Bernie Sanders groups. They were allocated for the larger landscape, which is the FDR Park. I believe it's like 365 acres. Some of the other groups I'm not too familiar with as far as like what their politics are, but I know there's some environmentalist groups also who are coming here to talk about the refinery issues that are taking place here in Philadelphia. But a lot of the groups who have maintained and gotten like their permits passed are Bernie supporters or those who are welcoming Bernie Sanders.
And those who have so far been denied permission or are pending.
Yes, and most of those are groups such as ours who are more left organized, left-wing organizations. We have one that was denied by the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign, which is one to end homelessness and one to receive adequate housing for the elders and those with disabilities. And we have ours, which is the Philly Coalition for Rural Justice, who is anti-police, anti-poverty, anti-gentrification, anti-establishment. We have one for the Workers' World Party as well, who is also anti-capitalism, anti-racist. And so those who have those broader messages that are speaking against like bringing down the establishment in a more effective way have definitely been denied for those reasons, I believe, particularly because of that.
And your group, if it doesn't get permission, are you going to march anyway?
Yes, our mission is that we have nothing to lose but our chains. So in the light of that, we are going to march because we know if we don't march, then we never win by becoming complacent or by conforming to the threats of police brutality, arrest, harassment, or whatever. So yes, we're marching with or without a permit. We live in this city, and this is our city. And if the convention is to come here, then they need to know what the masses are speaking of and what the masses look like. And because we know our struggles are the ones that they don't want to see, the ones that they don't want to recognize, we will make our presence known, and we will make sure that the delegates and those who are coming into the city as activists will understand that our struggles are the ones that really, truly need to be addressed, and that no candidate deserves a good night's sleep until they speak specifically to the issues that impact us and that literally determines our right to self-determination in this country.
That was Erica Mines of the Philly Coalition for Real Justice.
Money makes the world of the Democrats and the Republicans go round, according to Dr. Thomas Ferguson, professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts at Boston. Dr. Ferguson is author of the book, The Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Party Competition and the Logic of Money-Driven Politics. He says this election season has been quite unusual on both sides of the two-party system. Bernie Sanders mounted a challenge to the Democratic establishment with mostly small campaign contributions, and Donald Trump used his personal fortune to raise issues that Republicans hardly ever talk about. Does that mean Donald Trump marches to a different drummer?
This is a guy who can afford to pay his own band, if we're going to keep that metaphor. You had all these people walking around saying Jeb Bush got knocked over and he had $100 million that proves that money doesn't matter. Well, actually, no. If you look again at the Republican race, it looks just like the previous Republican race, and one is tempted to say the previous and the previous and the previous and the previous. You know, probably you could carry that back maybe to at least 1992, where you get a bunch of people talking forever about let's bomb somebody, generally in the Islamic world. Let's give everybody the right to bear any kind of arms they want. Let's cut social spending. Let's cut Social Security. Let's cut taxes on the rich. You know, the endless refrain. And I always thought it was plain that most humans in the United States didn't support that agenda. But everybody kept coming with it anyway in the Republican Party. And I thought then and think now that what made that go was the fact that essentially all the cash in the Republican Party was in favor of those principles, if you want to call them. I mean, the principle often is PLE is principle, PAL. And so suddenly Trump appears, and he doesn't need anybody's money. He doesn't need the Cox. He doesn't need the Bush Golden Horde. He doesn't need, you know, all the 1% folks who like Marco Rubio, et cetera. And he can do what nobody else can. He can just tell them to go fish. He can actually make an argument to voters. I mean, that's the really key point there. It was like letting a little fresh air into a tomb that had been sealed for 40 years or more. And some of the air There's no may about it. It was rancid, solid dose of sexism and racism, but it was fresh air. And he talked about a lot of things that nobody had in ages in the Republican Party. He said, no, you didn't need to cut Social Security. You didn't need to be endlessly at war with Russia. He mocked Wall Street, dumped on the carried interest tax loophole that investment houses use not to pay taxes like the rest of us. He could do all that because he had all the cash. It's not just that he had free TV or something like that. People can get free TV, at least for a while. Pat Buchanan got free TV for a while. You typically, what happens, though, is you get annihilated when you can't raise funds to go in a big multi-state primary after you do something in Iowa or New Hampshire. Everybody knew that was never going to happen to Trump. So, yes, he exploited free TV time handed to him by a media and all that. But in the end, he didn't need anybody else's money. He could say what he wanted. It's a kind of insane view of what a rational campaign finance system would bring the United States. It would bring a lot of debate. You'd hear all kinds of views. I actually think the public would do fine after, you know, maybe an initial shock of hearing some people say something they hadn't heard for a while. They'd sort out the stuff. I don't think that's really a problem. But the point is, money really mattered. He was a billionaire. And I would add this. This carries a very important implication. If he loses this general election, Trumpism could disappear as fast as it descended on us. That is to say, there probably won't be anybody else in the Republican Party doing the combination of issues that Trump did. And you got to be a real billionaire to just sort of thumb your nose at the political establishment there. That could vanish. I mean, people will be making gestures to anti-globalization, to all the people that have been left behind. But you won't see another campaign build on that unless it's self-financed. I mean, that's just the long and the short of it. Money is talking in this strange way to us, and I do think that's one of the most important lessons of the primaries.
Well, Trump may disappear, or Trump-like people may disappear from the Republican Party, and Sanders-like people may disappear from the Democratic Party, but the large numbers of folks who identified with those messages, they don't disappear.
No, they don't, but my take is pretty simple. American political parties are, first of all, bank accounts. That's what they actually are. And the rule is very simple. You can only make appeals to the public that you can finance. Somebody has to write a check. I mean, I know there are lots of people who they talk as though they think money grows on trees and it's just available in this infinitely elastic supply to whoever needs it. That's all garbage. I mean, you could see just how stupendous that worked in the Republican primary, which I think is just a laboratory pure example of this. You know, in the Democratic Party, it's pretty interesting. When Obama ran in 2008 and in 2012, there were some efforts in his campaign to make it look like a grassroots operation. And one of the things they did was to tell donors, if you're going to give a bunch of money, give it in small batches so we can say we've got small batches. I had one person actually read me an email they'd gotten from on a telephone that they'd gotten from the headquarters on that point. And my colleagues and I, Paul Jorgensen and G. Chen, and I wrote it up in an article we did. It published in 2013, International Journal of Political Economy. So one is always suspicious of claims that, well, small donations carried it. Now, it takes us a long time to work through the campaign finance data. We do it much more thoroughly than everybody else, and so it takes a lot longer. So we're behind. But I did look at some of the Sanders data, and I actually think in this case it's going to turn out to be true. You won't find lots of multimillionaires funding the campaign. It's going to turn out that this really was a largely small donations here, meaning probably under 500 and probably even less. I think it's true. It was a grassroots effort. Some other things about that campaign, I had a few occasional contacts with it, and it did resemble a whirlwind. But you were never quite clear who was in charge or how it was running, which, you know, sort of is the hallmark of real grassroots stuff. So I think there may be more of a future, actually, for alternative politics in the Democratic Party than in the Republican Party. We'll see. I do not doubt that if Hillary Clinton wins the presidential election, they'll spend a good deal of their time thinking, how do we effectively bottle up the Sanders supporters? But I suspect they can't do that because the fundamental issues here are stuff that neither Clinton nor the rest of the Republican Party want to address at all. I mean, which is that whole complex of issues about the fact that America is now a dual economy with huge chunks of the population just sitting out there in relatively low-wage industries. They haven't had a raise, waving a few years in the 90s for a generation as a group. And most people are on a treadmill to nowhere, and they know it. And that's what the Sanders and the Trump campaigns, each in their own way, sort of highlighted.
The last time I looked, Sanders had raised $132 million in small contributions, and that was said to make up 60% of his contributions. But was he able to raise this because he was a Democrat, or can the left fund itself?
Well, okay, tricky here. First point, without having seen exactly the numbers you're quoting, I can't say for sure, but I'm guessing that the implication that there were some large contributions there, not in small, I think they're talking about contributions from unions, mostly. That's my guess. I'm virtually certain there was no interesting super PAC running for Sanders, for example. That's why I think you get a relatively low number on that 60%, because most of the big unions either sat it out or supported Clinton. I mean, I don't think she'd have been nominated without the support of some of this, particularly in Iowa there early on. Sanders did get substantial union support, and that, if you count that stuff, well, then it'll look like, quote, big money. But, you know, we're talking here $5,000 to $25,000 mostly, I think. On the other side, I can't repeat too often my caution that the folks who normally report on campaign contributions do not do a good job of summing and then identifying contributions from the same people. Some of them make an effort. They're really poor at it. When my colleagues and I do it using programs that we often revised from the folks who did them and using the sort of program that you might if you're a hospital that takes over another chain and wants to know how many patients you share, we come out with much higher concentrations always than the usual ones reported. That's my caution on Sanders, but having looked at this stuff a little, not enough to say for sure, I think it's going to turn out. His boat floated on small contributions. I think it actually did happen.
But my question again is, can someone raise a respectable amount of money without being a Democrat?
Well, that's an interesting question, isn't it? I mean, I do think that the amount of money unions put into politics, most of it, nearly all of it, not quite all of it, to Democrats could be redirected and could go outside the party, and people might be better off. I understand why people are reluctant to do this. It is true that the rules have been so written so punitively that it is hard to get to sustain third parties. And I have often said, whatever your politics exactly, it's often convenient to run in the Democratic primary because you get around all those rules. I mean, I had a friend of mine. I mean, he was a friend of mine, but I'm not one of them, although some people claim I am a sort of left libertarian, and I don't mind that label a bit. But a friend of mine ran for governor in one state on the libertarian ticket. He was a political scientist. And he came back to me after that effort, and he said, well, I used to think you were exaggerating this business about the role of money, but I spent all of my time litigating to get on the ballot, and every nickel we spent had to be done on that. He was a sort of late convert to my sort of investment theory of political competition. So can you do it? I think actually you could. Whether there's a will to do it anywhere, it's not clear to me. Partly for good reasons and perhaps in many cases for bad reasons. It's very hard for me, for example, to understand, if I understand correctly what just happened on the Democratic Party platform, where they did not declare against the Trans-Pacific Trade Agreement, a bunch of unions that have been supporting the Clinton thing, you know, why didn't they get a commitment on that before they did that? I don't get it.
You seem to be saying that for dissident politics, the election route is a great sucking tube.
Well, doing nothing is a kind of sucking tube, too, though. I mean, let's be careful. But, yeah, look, I'm not telling you that election politics or alternative election politics in America is easy. Look, if you had told me a year and a half ago that Sanders would defeat Clinton repeatedly in major real state, as it were, primaries, not some tiny thing, and would sweep all kinds of state-run caucuses, I would have said, you know, you were smoking something, Glenn. You know, I mean, I admit this absolutely amazed me. So I'm not quite as, let's say, pessimistic as I was that you can't do anything. I just saw it happen. I saw water flow uphill for 5 or 6 months. It was pretty amazing. You know, I heard a guy on national TV begin in a debate by sort of saying, well, nobody's ever offered me six-figure salaries for a six-figure beach fees and things like that. I confess to being still amazed.
Well, Clinton clearly wants to create a big tent party, one that's full of refugee Republicans in flight from Donald Trump. Won't that make the Democratic Party in the end even more right-wing?
I think it may well work to that, yes. I think this is going to be very interesting. If you don't think it would work that way, you have to believe that you can give the Clinton campaign a lot of money and get nothing back from it. The record of the Clinton campaigns on money is not wonderful, and so I'm more than a little skeptical. No, I think that that is precisely where we are headed here, and then I'm not sure what's going to happen. I mean, one has to say that they didn't need all of the right-wing money to arrive fairly close to positions that aren't all that far from the right.
Dr. Thomas Ferguson of the University of Massachusetts in Boston.
Mumia Abu-Jamal, the nation's best-known political prisoner, is among the speakers who will address a mass meeting on the politics of incarceration in Palestine and the United States on July 15th at the Malcolm X and Betty Shabazz Educational Center in New York City. Niall Fort, a young minister and PhD candidate from Newark, New Jersey, is also a speaker, along with others who recently traveled to Palestine. We asked Niall Fort what Israelis' treatment of Palestinians has to do with mass black incarceration in the United States.
There's many connections that people have been making and we need to continue to make between what's happening with black people here in the United States and what is happening to Palestinians in Palestine. I think one of the obvious connections is the way in which the Israeli occupation is funded. There's an actual direct linkage between the U.S. government and the Israeli occupation just by pure dollars. I think to the tune of about $3 billion a year, the U.S. government is helping to fund the Israeli occupation. That is the apartheid wall, the apartheid court system. That is the military weapons, the IDF, the checkpoints, all of these everyday realities that Palestinians are living under. They don't just drop from the sky, they're paid for. And the U.S. government itself, like I said, helps that occupation, aids that occupation to the tune of about $3 billion a year. That's money that's not going to poor black folks. That's money that's not going to schools that are being shut down across the country. That's money that's being funded into our very own oppression. So I think from an economic standpoint, there's a direct connection. And to be sure, part of that $3 billion comes from our very tax dollars. So this isn't just decisions that are just being made without our complicity. So we have a moral obligation, I believe, to not only be aware of what's happening, but to begin to figure out how to organize against it. So that's one level. I think another level, when you look at the incarceration rates here in the U.S., a lot of people have been talking, especially on the left, about the sort of frenetic rise of prisons and incarceration across the United States. I think the statistic says 1 out of every 4 people that are imprisoned in the world are imprisoned in an American jail, juvenile detention center, or prison, even though we only have 5% of the world's population. And that's unbelievable injustice. What I think fewer people may know is that in Palestine, Palestinians are suffering under a similar sort of pattern of incarceration. One statistic says that 40% of all men are arrested and incarcerated at one point in their lives. Israel is the only country that prosecutes children in military courts. Children as young as 12 years old are being tried in military courts. We see similar sorts of treatment of younger people, particularly of color and black people here in the United States of America, who are being tried as adults at very young ages. So I think across the board, when we talk about economics, when we also talk about incarceration, there's an apartheid court system, not just an apartheid wall. But when you're Palestinian, you go to military court, and 99% of all cases end in convictions. When you look at the plea bargaining system that happens here in the United States, one statistic I read said about 90% of all people accept plea deals. That is, do not go to a trial where they have a jury of their peers, but they actually accept what's called the plea deal. And most of our criminal justice system runs on this plea bargaining system. I think there's a direct connection there, you know. So I'm not a scholar around this, but as someone who's just been trying to think with others about these connections, there's so many that we can make, one on the economic level, also on the incarceration level, but also just on a very humane level. I mean, you look at the kind of torture that's happening inside of the prison. So folks are not just being locked up, but they're being tortured. Some people are arrested and not told, this is in Palestine, why they've been arrested. They're in jailed and incarcerated for weeks and months at a time without any knowledge of why they've even been locked up. And so the level of anti-democratic sensibilities just pervade the court system, the criminal justice system there, as it does here in the U.S. I remember when I was in Ferguson, this is just sort of a storytelling point, when I was in Ferguson with other black millennials and black organizers, and when some of us were getting tear gas, you know, folks were learning how to deal with the tear gas through Palestinian young people who had already dealt with tear gas there in Palestine. And when I actually went to Palestine just a month ago, I went to a small village where I saw young children who had gotten so used to tear gas that when we got to the town and, you know, tear gas had been there the day before, we all began to sneeze and cough, and they were laughing at us. And they said, you know, y'all, this is something that we deal with every day. So I think there's many connections to be made, and that even if it's not the same situation, because it's not, we don't need to have sameness to have solidarity. There are many connections to be made economically around incarceration, around the sort of just inhumane treatment of human beings. These are crimes against humanity. But I also want to say that we don't need to have the same exact situation for black people, people of color, and all people who care about justice to do something about what's happening to Palestinian people in Palestine, and also black people here in the U.S., and all people who are suffering under similar oppressive conditions.
Yes, here in the U.S., lots of police officials see the Israelis as models in terms of how they contain the Palestinian population and handle Palestinian protests. And Israel figures highly in many U.S. police training programs as well.
It makes me think about the other side of it is surveillance. Right. So, you know, one of the things I noticed when I was on the ground going through the old city, going through Haifa, going through these different cities and these different towns, that you couldn't go anywhere without a camera watching you. So the amount of surveillance that's happening is just unbelievable. So when people say that Palestinian communities are open air prisons, it's not just the apartheid wall, but it's also the presence of the constant presence of surveillance. They have watchtowers where you don't know if someone's in it or not, but the point is that there's someone always watching you, watching your every move. As you try to live with dignity and decency in your everyday life, you are being watched and surveilled. And there's direct connections between how the U.S. is becoming more and more a national security state, where even under neoliberalism, all government isn't small. When it comes to surveillance, the government is actually getting bigger under neoliberalism. And I think we see something very similar in Israel in terms of surveillance. And as you mentioned, in terms of, you know, the militarization of police, the fact that people who are supposed to protect and serve communities are actually militarized, that they look more, even in Ferguson, like they're going to war with community people. You see that's the everyday life of many Palestinian communities and Palestine. So I think there's direct connections there. And again, this economically connected in terms of how the U.S. is funding it, but also in terms of training. And so how they are learning these different tactics from each other is also another point of entry. But also, you know, the beauty is that the connections are not just made across lines of oppression, they're also made across lines of resistance. And that's what the delegation was also about. It wasn't just about figuring out how we're equal oppressed in similar ways, but it's also about how we are resisting in similar ways and how we can learn from each other despite our different contexts of how to fight for freedom and do that in conjunction with each other, recognizing that we are part of a similar struggle.
Two delegations recently came back from Israel. There's going to be an event, and they're going to give reports on July 15th. Tell us about that.
I think first and foremost, it's important that everybody who cares about justice, and even those who are wondering what is this justice thing and freedom thing is about, comes out to the Malcolm X Betty Shabazz Center on July 15th. If you haven't heard about what's happening in Palestine, if you haven't heard about what's happening in terms of Black people and incarceration here in the U.S., this is a perfect opportunity for you to learn and become aware of what's happening, not only here in this country, but what's happening across the world and how those things are connected. So we want to make sure that people come out and learn. But also, if you already know about the situation, maybe you've read about it, maybe you've researched it, maybe this is something that you talk about every day, come and be a part of the community of people who are not just trying to talk about how bad things are, but are organizing and coming together to figure out what we can actually do about it. So I just encourage everybody to come out and learn. You're going to be hearing from people who went on it, delegations, myself included, but other people who've been doing this work for much longer than I have, who will come out and speak about their experiences in Palestine, give you firsthand accounts of what their eyes saw and their bodies felt on the ground, and what we have to do in this moment, even with so much turmoil happening in this country, what we have to do in terms of making solidarity with Palestinian people around the issue of incarceration, around the issue of the militarization of police, but also around the issue of just bare us coming together as human beings, trying to figure out how we can live with dignity and decency. So I encourage everybody to come out, young people, old folk, no matter where you at, if you are near the Malcolm X Betty Shabazz Center, please come out on July 15th to hear what's going on and figure out what we can do about it.
And of course, that's the center in New York City. And Mumia Abu-Jamal, the nation's best known political prisoner, will also speak.
Yes. And Mumia politicized me and radicalized me. So I feel like I'm coming full circle. You know, it's just not too long ago that I heard his voice. He was still on death row at the time. And so I think it's important for especially those of us who are entering into this movement work, this freedom work, us Black millennials, those of us who are trying to figure our way through this stuff, to not forget about the fact that it was the work of many political prisoners, including Mumia Abu-Jamal, who laid the groundwork for us to be able to even do some of the work that we're doing now. And we have to stand in that Black radical tradition of people like Mumia, who have analysis of not just racism, but also imperialism, about what the U.S. is doing across the country and across the world. And I think standing in that tradition has given me life, and I think it will give many of us life as we move forward in the work.
Meanwhile, New York's governor, Andrew Cuomo, is standing in the tradition of backing Israel to the hilt. He, by executive action, has set up a blacklist of companies and institutions that have chosen to honor the boycott, divest, and sanctions movement, BDS.
Absolutely. It shows, I think, that BDS is a threat. BDS is making some people who have a lot of power scared and nervous. And so they're trying to do something about it. You know, we're organizing, but the state is always constantly readjusting itself and reorganizing around our organizing. And so, you know, this is not a surprise to those who've been doing this work, whether it's anti-Zionist work or whether it's anti-racist work or the intersection of the two. So we shouldn't be surprised, but it really does speak to the sort of anti-democratic sensibilities, America that's supposed to be a place where people can assemble and protest and have freedom of speech. These are supposed to be our rights. Well, it doesn't apply to everyone, and it doesn't apply to every circumstance, clearly. And we know why that is. You know, we know that certain people who have certain ideas, who want to say certain things freely, are actually repressed when they try to do that. But we have to continue to organize and fight back, and people are doing that. I'm grateful to just be a part of that community.
That was Niall Fort speaking from Newark, New Jersey.
On the 4th of July, in the year 1852, the great abolitionist leader Frederick Douglass said, "There is not a nation on earth guilty of practices more shocking and bloody than are the people of the United States at this very hour." We spoke with Margaret Kimberly, Black Agenda Report editor and senior columnist, and asked her if Frederick Douglass's assessment sounds familiar in the present day.
It does sound familiar. Douglass's great speech is something that we all need to remember on July 4th when we are enjoying the day. And keep in mind that 160 years later, that is still true. At the time, the United States was run by the slaveocracy or the slave power who controlled politics in the United States. Every act that the government committed, from stealing half of Mexico to spreading from sea to shining sea, as it were, was an attempt to spread the plantation chattel slavery economy, with all of the horrors that are required, frankly, in order to maintain a system of that kind. Since that time, U.S. imperialism has invaded numerous countries. The United States is the only country to use a nuclear weapon. The United States now has a military presence in over 100 countries. There's no other nation like that. The United States kills people at will. It's Congress says nothing. The corporate media say nothing. The two major parties collude. So everywhere from Gaza to Somalia to Afghanistan, and I know I'm leaving many nations out, the U.S. is responsible for terrible crimes.
Yes, depending upon how you count them, the U.S. is involved in at least 7 wars. President Obama was elected as the anti-Bush. But almost 8 years later, he looks like Bush number 3.
Yes, I think they're all Bush. You know, it's in the job description. You know, we spend more than a year electing a president acting as though there's some difference. In order to get the job, the president has to be an imperialist. There is no way that the ruling classes will allow anyone else to be president. The capitalists require that the president be an imperialist. So the question is, merely how much, what the scale will be, how well he or she can lie and pretend to be otherwise. But anyone who gets into that office will end up the same. There's no peacemaker that will end up sitting behind a big desk in Oval Office.
Well, imperialism seems to have gotten into bed with some strange fellows, ISIS, Al-Qaeda in Syria.
Well, you know, the jihadists, ever since the late 70s, this is something that began with the Carter administration using jihadists to fight the Soviets in Afghanistan. And it's been a loop of disaster and suffering for people, mostly in that part of the world. First was the Taliban, and now the Taliban are evil, but they were America's friends, lest we forget. September 11th, that was blowback from people like Osama bin Laden, who was, at the time, an ally of the United States. So then we go on to Libya, where jihadists were used to overthrow the Gaddafi government, making an attempt to do the same thing in Syria. Assad has held on, and the Russians finally came to his aid, though success is a lot less likely there. It may just be a terrible stalemate. But these are America's allies. They go into the places where the U.S. cannot or will not send American troops. And that's the Obama doctrine, to do the same thing Bush did without sending U.S. troops. That's the biggest reason that there was so much protest in 2003 before the invasion of Iraq. So now it is getting other people, ISIS, Al-Qaeda offshoots such as al-Nusra in Syria, to do America's work for it. But there will always be blowback. There was much political hay made out of the killing of the U.S. ambassador in Libya and whether Hillary Clinton, the Secretary of State, was culpable, but they were all culpable. He was killed by the people that Democrats and Republicans alike said would be our foot soldiers, as you put it.
We've seen this insurgent Democratic campaign on the part of Bernie Sanders, and he talked a great deal about domestic issues and about the trade issues and such, but he didn't seem to have any kind of real critique of U.S. foreign policy.
No, he did not. I believe he was never serious about winning the nomination. I don't think he believed he would do as well as he did. But initially, his website, when he first announced his campaign, made no mention of foreign policy at all. And then when it did, it was pretty much straight down the line with the Obama policy. He would say he was in favor of the kill list. He thought it was okay. He just said, you know, don't kill so many people or don't send so many drones. He would claim, or rather give an appearance of change in policy vis-a-vis Israel. He would actually say the Palestinians were nice people and they deserved to live. Well, no one should get praised for saying that. Everyone should agree on the Palestinians' humanity and their human rights that ought to be respected, but it was no change from U.S. foreign policy. About Russia, they all sounded the same. All the Republicans, all the Democrats, we have to contain Russia and Putin is a menace and et cetera, with the lies about Russia when it's the United States doing the threatening, actually. So his foreign policy was really no different than Hillary Clinton's, and it's one of the reasons I personally did not understand why so many people on the left were so supportive of him.
Some of us are quite amazed that in Great Britain, which is not so great anymore, both of the major parties, the Conservatives and Labour, the leadership both wanted Britain to stay inside the European Union, but somehow a referendum was allowed to take place, and it looks like Britain will leave the EU. And capitalists all over the world are acting as if their system's in danger. Is their system in danger? And is that a bad thing?
I wish it were in danger. The system is not in danger, but it is a hiccup. And that means it is a good thing. This is an interesting example of unintended consequences. Prime Minister Cameron was under pressure from those in his party to offer a Brexit vote. Clearly, nobody thought that the population would vote to leave the EU. They managed to frighten people in Scotland a couple of years ago, and I think they thought they could do the same thing again, where there was a vote for Scottish independence. And Scottish voters ultimately rejected it. And I think they felt the same thing was going to happen again. This was a serious political miscalculation for which the world should be grateful. So now 17 million people said, yes, leave the EU. This clearly is a problem for the imperialist project, for the capitalist project. Barack Obama was in London a couple of months ago and said, oh, it would be a terrible thing for Britain to leave the EU, which should have been an indication that it would, in fact, be a good thing. But the EU is an American project. The countries within the EU bend to U.S. will, so that when, for example, Germany was willing to let Greece leave the Eurozone, the U.S. said no, because they didn't want them to potentially become close to Russia. The EU tore Ukraine apart by forcing them to choose who it would seek assistance from. And when they chose Russia, which was the logical choice, they then instigated a coup. Turkey, they bribed Turkey to keep refugees there and keep them from going to other European countries. Now, there wouldn't be any refugees if the EU and NATO, and they're very closely linked, hadn't helped the U.S. in trying to overthrow the Syrian government. So there's nothing good about the EU, nothing democratic about the EU. It is a means of making it easier to move capital back and forth and for less prosperous countries to have their people have freedom to travel and go to other countries to work, which helps them out. It helps relieve the pressure in Poland or Greece or Spain, but it creates resentment in the UK, where people have seen their living wage jobs disappear for the same reason Americans have, because of neoliberalism and the destruction of their manufacturing base. So, and that was the impetus for most people. It was immigration. However, the end result is a good one because there is now chaos politically in the UK. The country may eventually break up after all. Scotland voted to stay, and this time around, if there's another referendum, they may in fact vote to leave the UK altogether, Northern Ireland, same thing. So it would be a very good thing if Britain devolved over this issue because it is America's number one junior partner. If America wants to invade Iraq, Britain helps. America wants to destroy Libya or Syria, Britain helps. So a weakened, broken up Britain is a good thing for the world.
Might the United States try to further unify its European junior partners by whipping up further antagonism with Russia?
That danger still exists. Britain's political troubles make that a little less likely right now. They can't figure out who the next prime minister is going to be and put troops on Russia's border. So, you know, two things are possible. It could make it less likely that they go that route. On the other hand, these are human beings with human motivations, and at a time of crisis, they may act in a way that provokes the situation further already. But I tend to think that in this moment of a destabilized NATO and EU, that this could put the brakes on any misadventures, at least temporarily.
On the 4th of July, Americans make a great deal about their freedoms, and Republicans and Democrats claim that much of the world hates the United States because they resent our freedoms. But by at least one measurement, the United States is the most unfree country in the world because it puts more of its own people in prison than anybody else. Some prisoners are issuing a call on September 9th.
Yes, on September 9th of this year will be the 45th anniversary of the Attica Revolt, which took place in upstate New York. After a four-day long siege of the prison, more than 40 people were killed, prisoners and prison employees. Since that time, incarceration rates have skyrocketed in the country. I believe they've tripled in the past 40 years. So there are even more people behind bars. We now have a privatized prison system where there's actually an incentive, a financial incentive, to put people behind bars. Corporations get paid to keep people behind bars. Prisoners are forced to work for the prison system to make many products. We should have a law that says products have to say made in prison, just as something has to say made in China or made in France. And it would shock people to know how many of the products we use are made behind bars. The people on the help desks that we call for a variety of services are often people in prison. So on September 9th, there's been a call across the country for prisoners to go on strike. So on September 9th of this year, hopefully there will be a very strong prison strike involving many of the 2 million people behind bars.
Not just the corporate media, but much of what passes for black leadership over the past 40 years have ignored black mass incarceration. But now that issue seems to be the cutting edge of what could be a new movement.
It could be. You know, we can't depend on the leaders and the misleaders, as we call them, to step forward on anything that is really of vital importance. So that is why it's so important for those of us on the outside to keep raising the issue of police brutality, which feeds the prison system. So we need to be independent of the politics, which has helped get us in this mess, where Hillary Clinton, whose husband accelerated the mass incarceration system, where black elected officials almost to a person endorsed her presidency. And she herself has said many times, or she used to say, that she was in favor of those policies. So we can see where this led us 20 years after this disaster began. Black leadership has endorsed the spouse and co-president of the man who created and enlarged this living hell for us.
Bar editor and senior columnist Margaret Kimberly.
Holidays like the 4th of July don't mean much to the 2.2 million people locked up in this country's prisons. Political prisoners Jan Lahman has for months been denied direct communication with the outside world. His commentary for Prison Radio is titled Prisoners' Voices Blocked and Censorship of U.S. Prisons. It is read by Lynn Stewart, the people's lawyer who has also been a political prisoner herself.
These present words are written by Jan Lahman. Quote, "The United States is often called the country of prisons because we are 5% of the world's population, but the U.S. holds 25% of all the prisoners in the world. Recently, we have heard talk from the White House and Congress about the need to reduce this huge prison population, which is costing the taxpayers billions. Occasionally, you might hear a prisoner's voice on some media platform, usually a human rights or community outlet. I am a long-held political prisoner, presently locked up in the U.S. Penitentiary in Tucson, Arizona. Let me be very clear. Prisoners have a hard time getting our words and thoughts out from behind America's many, many prison walls. While prisoners do have a legal right to express their thoughts and report on issues and abuses, actually getting your words out is often very hard or impossible. All incoming and outgoing prisoner communication, postal mail, phone calls, and some restricted email services that some prison systems allow are all opened and monitored. This is authorized by regulations and law. Further censorship and outright blocking of communications and publications also routinely occurs in prisons throughout this country. Letters, magazines, and books critical of government policies and wars are often not delivered, even if official policy states that prisoners are allowed these materials. Sometimes a prisoner has all his or her phone or email communications arbitrarily shut off for months. While an official appeal channel is usually available, these are biased at best and could easily be labeled a kangaroo court process. Communications would be shut down for months, even if the prisoner ultimately wins appeal and has his or her communications restored. Censoring, restricting, and flat-out blocking communications, especially of political prisoners, is a harsh and dangerous reality going on now in prisons all across this country. My own voice, which has previously been heard on radio and in print over many years, has been almost totally cut off since February. No official explanation has been given, other than prison authorities do not like my commentaries and essays. Freedom of speech, freedom of expression for America's prisoners is a constant struggle. These words are from Jan Lahman, and I hope I can, once again, speak more directly to you in the future.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.